It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Jeff and Gina are here. We're going to take a look at a brand new email program for your mobile and web from Google. A replacement for Gmail, possibly. Twitter takes a pivot with its new developer platform. We'll talk about that. And Jeff finally understands why WhatsApp is worth $22 billion. It's all coming up next on Twig.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com.
This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 272, recorded October 22nd, 2014. Check your inbox. This Week in Google is brought to you by Hover.com. Hover's the best way to buy and manage domain names. It's simple, it's honest, it's easy to use. For 10% off your first purchase, go to Hover.com and enter the promo code TWIG10. And by SmartThings, the easiest way to create a smart home. SmartThings lets you control your home using your smartphone from anywhere. For 10% off any home security or solution kit, visit smartthings.com/twit and use the code TWIT10. And by Shutterstock.com. With over 42 million high-quality stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 20% off image subscription packages on your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use the offer code TWIG1014. It's time for Twig This Week in Google. A show that not just about Google, but the cloud, Facebook, Twitter, anything we really want to talk about, including new media. That's partly because we've got this guy over here, Jeff Jarvis, professor of journalism at the City University of New York, turning young minds onto the possibilities that remain in the tattered wreck that is journalism.
Corrupting them.
Great to have you, Jeff. Also here, founding editor of Life Hacker, programmer, developer, host of All About Android, and the creator of ThinkUp, Gina Trapani. ThinkUp.
Hello.
Hi, Gina. Gina did us a mitzvah, Jeff.
She did indeed. She did a couple of mitzvahs. What's the plural of mitzvah?
Mitzvah? Mitsubishi? It's a Mitsubishi.
She, I know what?
She sent us invites to a new Google service that I think is kind of on the order of Gmail when it first came out in terms of people wanting it. It's called Inbox, and it's, they say, a marriage of Gmail and Google Now.
Just to be clear, before I start getting a barrage of emails, I do not issue the invites.
Yes.
Okay. I just happen to have
Googlers
who follow me on Twitter. I asked, they sent exactly three. So
thank you, Gina.
I saved them to my co-hosts.
So it's a really,
I don't have invites.
Hard to know exactly what this is. And by the way, you can go to google.com/inbox and request an invite. That's where you should go.
Yes,
and soon they'll open it up.
When do Well, maybe I don't know. Gmail. Remember, Gmail was in beta and you invite only for some time.
That was an earlier Google.
So what is this, and why should we want it?
Explain it to us, Lucy.
Yeah, because both Jeff and I have it, but we don't know what the hell to do with it.
I'm also kind of trying to figure out what this is. I've only had it for an hour or so, and I'm still kind of confused by it. But in short, it's a new updated client for Gmail, which exists on Android, iOS, and the web at inbox.google.com. And it adds features to, it's kind of like Gmail supercharged. It's got a little Google Now action where you can say, set a reminder and remind me about this email in 2 days. It's got some, snooze this, mark this as done. It bundles different types of emails, similar to the way Priority Inbox groups emails by subject. It's all material design. It's all kind of a new take on, it's got lots of different cool interactions. But I'm still figuring it out. I'll be really honest.
I
haven't quite gotten my head around this.
It reminds me a little bit of Mailbox, which is an app we've talked about. First came out on iOS, then Macintosh, and I think there's Android versions now. Same idea. In fact, Mailbox really opened people's eyes to a new way of handling mail. You swipe left or right. Mailbox has four different states. You could swipe all the way to the left to delete it, sort of the way to the left to archive it, all the way to the right to make it to snooze it. This has those features in it. But as you point out, it also incorporates those new categories that were introduced in Gmail a while ago, promos. But they have new ones too. They call these bundles. So there's purchases, promos. Promos are, you know, basically bacon, right? Stuff you agreed to sign up for, but don't really want to read. Purchases are actually what you want. Nowadays, especially with Google Wallet and Apple Pay, purchases will collate all of the receipts into one package. Your orders, too. There's travel. I'm about to travel, and it'd be kind of nice to have, you know, all the emails associated with my flight, my rental car, my hotel in one folder.
And again,
travel.
It's not just that you have the email in one spot. It's that the preview in the listing alone tells you what you need to know.
Right. Right, so here's a Virgin America reservation on their sample page, and there's a link that says check in.
What's the URL on that page we're looking at right there?
This is google.com/inbox.
Google.com/inbox.
This is their preview page. And you can create your own bundle. So I would create, for instance, a Twit bundle for emails from the twit.tv domain. I see they have Book Club, Weekend Woohoo, Ski Buddies as samples. So your bundles could be added to the list of bundles. So bundles are essentially email filters. In fact, the setup is very much like setting up an email filter.
Yeah.
So it's little bits and pieces from...
What do you go through?
Say again?
Can you do a never show me this again bundle?
Yes. Yes, you could, I presume. But it's very easy to get rid of stuff by swiping it off. You swipe it one way, it gets rid of it. Swipe it the other way, it snoozes it.
So, all right, hold on. Let me understand. So you swipe it the one way, that's telling Google, I don't care about this. You swipe it the other way, it's telling Google, yes, I care about this.
Kind of, sort of. Well, it's telling Google, remind me about this later.
Remind me about this later. Yeah, I don't care about this right now.
Because the problem is, because here's an issue I can imagine for Google. Because you can now see the essence of the email in the preview, you might swipe it off. You might say, thank you. Great. I now found out everything I need. That was very important to me, and swipe it off. Or you could say, ugh, I hate this. I don't want this. I don't care. Please don't prioritize this in the future, Google, and swipe it off. If the same action is the same signal, that I don't know how they're going to prioritize well. But they'll figure it out.
It's interesting.
Hmm. Yeah, this is pretty interesting.
If you do it on the web, by the way, obviously, it's not a touch screen, so swiping isn't available.
Unless you have a Chromebook Pixel.
Unless you're on.
Well, I'd be curious if it knows that you have touch, because
I'll find out.
Desktop, I don't have touch, but I have buttons for PIN. We didn't mention PIN. PIN is another category. What you could do to triage your email is PIN everything you want to save, and then there's a sweep button. Microsoft invented this for Outlook Mail that will sweep unpinned items off as done. So I think the idea is somewhat like the triage capabilities of Mailbox, where you're going toward inbox zero. You're very quickly dealing with everything. Either get rid of it, do something about it, postpone it, or pin it, and then you sweep everything else away.
But you see, that's not my behavior. Google taught me not to do that. Google taught me just to leave it, and it'll go out below.
Well, it doesn't get rid of it. It just puts it in a...
But I don't even do it. Most of my email, I don't do anything to. I say, okay, I personally don't care.
If you look at my email, I have like 30,000 unread emails.
And by the way, on my wonderful Pixel, sweeping of an individual item doesn't work.
Yeah. You have to still use those buttons.
Oh, dang.
Yeah.
I was hoping the web-based material design would be touch-sensitive. That's interesting. Okay. Yeah.
Anything you've marked done is stored in a done folder, as well as our... So done just means I'm done with this one.
Is that an alias to archive? It must be.
This is the other question. Mail. Yeah, what happens to your normal Gmail? Is this... I mean, are you affecting Gmail itself?
You've got to be, right?
Yeah, you are.
Yeah, anything you mark done is safely stored here. Emails you previously archived are here, too.
So it's added. Has it added?
So
let me look. It is archive. Because I don't see new boxes with the labels that they talk about. Oh, maybe I do. I see social promote. Yeah, I do. So you'll also see, if you've turned on categorization in the email inbox on Gmail, you'll also see those categories there. And I presume if I add another bundle, I will see that category too. So bundles equal labels in Google, right. Google speak.
They behave slightly differently, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, a bundle does have different characteristics.
It seems like the group...
I can't put bundles I create in the categories list. They now become a new label. So bundles I create are really just labels. The bundles Google's created are more categories. They go in the categories section.
Right. They seem to group similar emails in a way even beyond just conversation threads.
Right. I like that. I mean, Google does it. And I think, as I remember, Jeff, you did not turn on categories in your Gmail. You didn't like that.
I didn't.
The automatic thing.
Exactly. And this got, I wish I could show you guys this. This has got some Google Now action going on. So I'm checking in on a Virgin America flight tomorrow. And so I have my Virgin America, you know, it's time to check in email. And I've got, you know, the flight number. It looks very Google Now-ish. It expands down the flight number, link to check in, you know, New York, San Francisco. Like it knows that the email.
So the key to this to me is that preview is that you don't need to open a lot of it. You'll have to open email a lot less of the time.
Well, what you do is you open inbox instead of email.
That's what I'm saying. You just,
yeah,
you just
pull but inbox kind of is email
for you at a glance,
right? I mean, I'll make a commitment to use this for the next week.
I can't do it. I don't use my vanilla Gmail account
it doesn't for my apps. Account. I never use.
Yeah.
Google.
All right, will use it.
You keep promising you're going to fix this and you don't. I yelled at you when I was out there. I love you guys, but really, really, come on.
This doesn't. Are you saying this doesn't work with your apps account?
No.
Right. Not yet.
It was even worse than that, Leo. Gina nicely sent the invite to me to my apps account. I open it up and it says, "Oh, sorry, sucker." So she had to send it to my Gmail account for it to work.
Yeah, it actually detected whether or not it was in your Gmail inbox. Just, you know, they can do that, right?
And, you know, this is, let me just say, because I went and talked to the work people. Work! Those people are paying for apps now. They're paying for apps functionality. To make apps people second-class citizens, not the best thing, Google. Not the smartest thing.
I have to say, I have some trepidation about completely trusting this.
Leo, moment
of zen. Trust the machine,
Leo. We all said the same thing, I think, when Priority Inbox came out, and it has not failed me. It is rare.
You're still using that.
At the bottom of the screen.
See, I don't use Priority anymore because I moved to the next thing Google invented called Categories. Scattergories.
Scattergories.
So I don't have a Priority Inbox. I have a Primary Inbox. Same idea, though. And that's been reliable. And so in a way, having gotten used to now the idea that promotional stuff is in one tab and updates are in another tab, I am perhaps now more likely to use Inbox. I'm glad they keep trying.
Priority Inbox just means I ignore more people without guilt, which I guess is a nice thing. I mean,
see, this is part of the problem is that email is so broken and everybody's trying to figure out a way to fix it.
Well, you can't fix email as is. You can't add on to the existing infrastructure and it's not going to work.
And that's what this is, I'm sorry to say.
Oh, it has to be, but you've got to totally create an entirely new email infrastructure and ecosystem.
Right.
That's the kind of ambition Google could have.
So the other problem I have is that you and I, Jeff, we don't do much with our emails, so we just have 14,838 unread emails in my inbox.
You especially, because the world emails you.
Well, I get a lot of email, but... this is really about inbox zero, isn't it? I mean, this only makes sense if I sweep it every day.
Yeah.
No, because I think those previews are key to this.
But I have all this stuff. I mean, I could scroll forever. I have all this stuff from previous days. Maybe I should just sweep that out of the way. The problem is, doesn't it do that on my Gmail? So, but now it's in the done. I don't know.
I disagree. Google always still believes in search. It's not going to get you to Gmail. You can sweep stuff up, but you can also just let it go down the screen.
Right.
And it has a clear demarcation for today and yesterday, which is kind of nice. Because it kind of says, If it was yesterday and you didn't deal with it, you could go back there, but you don't have to. It's just still there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you only sweep a day's worth of mail when you sweep. Isn't that right? Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Looks that way.
So you sweep each day by itself.
So in the rundown, under this story, I put a report, there were a couple of them, about a leak of Gmail 5.0 two days ago.
Yeah, I believe that this is a different thing.
Oh,
that's
great.
What I'm asking.
Well, yeah, I think that the Gmail 5.0 is actually an upgrade to the native default Gmail
for Lollipop.
For Lollipop, yeah.
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of 5.0 versions. There's Play Store 5.0 as well.
Right.
That are a lot. They're basically Lollipop-ized.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but the Gmail 5.0, according to the report, will also handle Yahoo Mail and other such
things. As it should.
Right.
Because doesn't the default AOSP email program do that already?
Yeah, right. So there's a default email client, which is a generic IMAP POP email client, right? And now, and then there's the Gmail app, which handles Gmail.
Just
right?
Gmail.
Just Gmail. Now, you could always POP or IMAP, or I guess just POP to Gmail on the web and then have that bring down, you know, or have your email forwarded. This is different. This is actually Gmail, the client, acting as just a straight POP3 or
Unified
IMAP
Inbox,
client.
as most mail clients will do.
Okay, that's all.
And I think that means is they're going to deprecate the AOSP email client, and Gmail going forward, Gmail 5.0 will be the default email client in AOSP. Okay, that would be my guess.
I don't think so.
No?
I think there's proprietary code. I don't think that they're going to open source the Gmail app. There's proprietary code there.
Ah, you're right. So this is why you have to buy a Nexus 6 phone, know what is official, what is open. But I would guess that on most Nexus phones, Gmail will be kind of the default email app, right? I don't even know if they'll include an email app, because it'll do everything the email app will do.
Yeah. Yep.
But and just to make things more confusing, they've introduced a third mobile email app called Inbox. Just because we weren't yet baffled enough. I like Inbox, though. I think I could get used to it.
Now, here's the other question I'm going to have, is that because I'm a Chrome user on airplanes, I use offline email Chrome app, which is really useful because I can read my mail offline. And the question is, will they make this an offline app as well?
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, interesting. Yeah, I mean, it seems like it makes sense that this would be an offline app as well, but probably not there yet. Right, don't you have to sync? You have to install it as a Chrome app and then sync it. You say get, you know, sync, and then you get on the plane and you've got everything.
You know what I'd almost like to see is them turning Gmail into a true plain IMAP client, because right now it has extensions that, for instance, in IMAP, emails in one and exactly one folder. In with Google's labels, you could have multiple labels. And so there's no direct mapping of Google's Gmail organizational strategy to an IMAP organizational strategy. What if Google just went to true IMAP? That's been a problem, for instance, for Apple and its mail app. What if Google just made Gmail an IMAP standard email client and then used these third, you know, these other mobile clients and new desktop client as a way of doing its oddball labeling system? I think that would be good. Then we wouldn't have a non-standard IMAP on Gmail.
But there's still back-end functionality for example, Priority Inbox that adds a lot of value.
Yeah.
So it's not – Gmail is never going to be, again, just a plain vanilla straight feed email account. You could make it into that.
I mean,
the real value add of it is Priority Inbox and the thinking that goes into the organization of your email.
Because Priority Inbox is one of many labels a single mail can have.
And there's a lot of thinking that goes in behind that. A lot of computing goes into that.
Well, it's just filtering.
It's filtering, but it's very smart filtering.
Oh, okay. But it's
multiple labels isn't going to go
away.
I mean, they're not incentivized to get rid of that at all, right? I mean, they're incentivized to get more Gmail users, right? Like, so their IMAP implementation is a little janky. It works, right? I mean, technically it works, even though... You know, one piece of mail could be in several different folders, right? They're not actually folders, but I don't see them backing off on the multi-label feature because I think it's one of the few things that, like, distinguishes Gmail, right?
Yeah, it's real value add.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Gene, I got a different question.
Okay.
So this is presented as an Android / iOS mobile app, but it also exists on the web. Does this indicate anything about their thinking about Android v. Chrome, Android v. web, in how things are being developed, what they're being developed for?
Well, this web app at inbox.google.com looks very material design. It's got
That's
the floating
why I'm
asking.
Exactly
action
why I'm asking
button.
That, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's got that floating action button. It's got the transitions and the list items that kind of expand in place and the nice kind of sliding back and forth. I think that they use Polymer to build this. Polymer is a framework that basically lets developers, you know, create material design-ish apps on the web. So yeah, I mean, I think that Google is moving totally into this direction. I think we're going to see it on the web. I think we're going to see it in their Android apps. I think that this material design is actually going to be, we're going to see influences of it everywhere.
I have to say, I've just been playing around with this inbox, and it is a nice thing to be able to really quickly triage email and then sweep the rest away. I just went through my whole updates folder and picked one thing I wanted to save, swept the rest away. That's great. Same thing with my finance folder. I can go through here, and this is all the credit card, you know, warnings and stuff. And I can just say, okay, got it, sweep it away. This is good. This might be a good solution.
I dig it.
I dig it, man.
But it is a learning curve. But I like it a lot. I want it. I want it for my apps account. I want it for my primary email.
Yeah.
So you can't use this as an apps with your apps account.
It says it said your organization isn't ready for this.
Yes, they are.
I think it's a terms of service privacy issue. I think that it takes them longer, like for whatever legal reasons, to opt apps organizations into the kind of permissions.
Yeah, giving them excuses. I still think they haven't figured out the damned to account thing.
Yeah, that's fair. Maybe.
I love them. I love them. They do amazing work. But you know, this is the when Gene and I were going to the email back and forth. I just said, you know, Q Jarvis S Fit.
Did say that, didn't it? Hey, I've just gone through all of my while you have been talking, gone through all of my email, and swept away everything but three messages which I pinned. I got to at least daily inbox zero.
For 10 minutes. Congratulations.
Yeah, that's great.
I mean,
that was really easy, but that was great.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly was the purpose of apps like Mailbox, right?
So,
and it seems like Inbox is following in those footsteps, is giving you an easy way to clear out your inbox
quickly. It's very influenced by Mailbox, isn't it?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Although not a lot of people, not everybody clears out their inbox every day.
No, I don't. That's why it's such a big deal that I did for the first time in my life.
Mm-hmm.
While you were talking. and it does reflect itself back on your regular Gmail interface, which is nice.
So when you pin it, what happens with it?
It then now stays in that inbox until you handle it.
Okay.
And when you pin something, you can no longer sweep it away. So what you do, so this is what I just did. I went through each bundle, scanned it, pinned the ones I knew I wanted to act upon, ignored the ones I knew I didn't care about now that I've read them or at least looked at them, and swept everything away. So I had basically...
That's like starring was, but instead of going into a separate star category, it now stays in the feed,
yes.
Right?
And you have this sweep command, which means that once you've starred stuff, you can get rid of the stuff you starred.
Right. And then you can separately, you can say, remind me about this in 3 days, right?
Yeah, that's a separate thing.
A separate thing.
So there's pinning and there's snoozing. Pinning is saying, stay here, I'm not done with you. Snoozing is remind me tomorrow. And I did snooze three or four things.
And there's archiving and killing. There's not, because before you really basically couldn't kill Gmail. I mean, that you could, but they made it difficult. They said, why bother? So now there's a distinction between archiving and killing?
Yeah.
Trash or archive.
Yeah, you don't
that's
have
new,
a trash button
new
on this,
in terms
by the way.
Of the way they think about it.
There's no trash button on this. The worst you can do to email is put it in done. Which you say, Gina, is the same as the archive.
There are times when you want to erase things. I mean, in your own email, you have a right to forget.
No, sorry.
Or I erase an email.
Nope, sorry. You don't get to erase, it looks
that's,
like.
That's an issue. For companies that have lawyers saying, get rid of the digital paper trail here.
Oh, wait a minute. I take it back. Okay. So the big three buttons and the swipe choices are pin, snooze, done. But then there's a menu. There's a three-button menu thing. And in there, it says move to, and among other things, you can move it to trash or move it to spam or move it to bundles or unbundled. So
I have this vision that somewhere at Google right now, there's a three people from this team having beer laughing at us. No, Leo, look over there.
No, I think what they're doing is rooting for us. He'll figure it out. Yeah. Come on. They're not laughing. They're going, okay, do you get it? Do you get it? No? Okay, keep trying. I think this actually, I'm kind of liking it. But
we'll see.
The location-based reminders are pretty cool, too. Pick
it
a place.
Does that?
Yeah, so you can say snooze until. There are a couple of preset choices later today, tomorrow. You can pick a date, a time, or then you can just pick a place.
Oh.
So when I get to work, remind me about this email.
By the way, even though I swept my inbox, now there's like 30 more emails in there. Gosh, darn it.
That's the problem.
I told you.
I just
that
fixed
was
it.
The only time.
I just cleaned you out. That's when you're going to give up, is what's going to happen.
Is it fan email? What fills you up immediately?
Just, yes, lots of stuff.
Bacon.
It's a lot of bacon.
Because you sign up for crap over the years.
No, but I mean, it's also, you know, anytime I use my credit card, card not present, I get an email. Anytime I also turn on alerts and financial things, and there's just a lot of email. There's just a lot.
I go back. The thing I've mentioned on the show over the years is that Marissa and I are talking about the hyper-personal news stream. Right? Google is trying to let you know at a glance what you need to know in the context of your needs, right? That's Google's goal. And they very cleverly, bit by bit, piece by piece, find new ways. Here's the way I've been putting it lately. In Seoul, they asked me to do what would Google do presentation. I'm thinking it's 5 years old. But, hey, great. What would Google do 5 years later? So, you know, I look back and Android was new in that time. And I really saw that Google is a personal services company.
Yeah, I agree.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's the key. That's just so key to where Google is. And I saw the glimmers of where it was going, but it just this whole notion that I talk about of them being in the signals business. The reason is because they, unlike mass media, unlike mass manufacturers and marketers, unlike government, Google gives you personal service. That's their goal.
And what better thing for them to put their big brains to work on than solving email?
But again, that's what I said earlier in the show. I think that's not they have not moonshotted this. The moonshot for email is to invent an entirely new.
That was Google Wave, and we saw what happened with
it. Well, it was because it was recipient controlled communication.
Right. Wave was absolutely a moonshot. In fact, it was wasn't it some of the Gmail team was involved.
It was the Google Maps team.
It was the Maps team.
Lars and his brother. Yeah, it came from Maps.
Rasmussen's.
Yeah, I mean, Wave was a shot at that. Buzz, you know, you could argue that social networks are the better email. The reason why I defend email and I want email to stick around because it's the only truly federated system that everybody uses.
Wow, that's great.
You know what I mean? That's easy to set up and everyone uses.
Yeah, we're not reinventing email. We're reinventing how we perceive it and process it.
Yeah, but you're trying to fix its inherent vulnerabilities and weaknesses.
Well, and there's nothing.
Google could invent something new that's federated.
No. It wouldn't be federated. It'd be Google. And then you'd have to get everybody else to agree to do it.
Here's the difference, because Gina was right. Just a minute. Google Plus, my friend Bob Wyman at Google lectured me years ago, and he said, Jarvis, the problem with email, that from the day one, I know the day the decision was made, is when it became sender control. And we've talked about this in the show back when Google Plus started. Google Plus is recipient controlled. And that's the essence of an entirely different communication schema. But you're right. That's just Google. And that's the weakness of it is it's just Google. What if you truly could imagine a federated recipient controlled Google Plus where you're still going to have email, Gina, and you're still going to get the stuff that you didn't ask for and whatever. And Google's still going to help you try to fix that as best as it can. What if all your really important communication went through? Now, what do we do instead, right? We try Facebook, but Facebook is controlled, not federated, limited. It's the closest thing we have to everybody being there, but it's not built to communicate. It's not what it's there for.
What is federated? Would you explain that, Gina? I think Gina could do this.
Federated is a peer-to-peer network where there's several different servers, all of whom have the same, are on the same ground, right? They all have the same amount of power, and they exchange information peer to peer. They're equals, exactly. Versus a collection of servers controlled by one company that serves out to clients.
So when email servers, first started, it was that latter situation. You had MCI mail, or you had Genie, or you had AOL, or you had CompuServe, and you could email anybody within that system. But getting email from MCI to AOL was very hard because it had to go through a gateway, and it, you know, it was just hard. You had to know how to do it. You had to know the right address. So they solved that problem by federating, by saying, look, everybody has a canonical email address that is, you know, some name at, and the host that hosts your email, AOL or Genie or MCI mail. So they had a system of naming that everybody understood, and then they set up the interconnect so you didn't have to even think about it. You just, I would write to Gina at AOL.com and it would get to you.
And this is pre-TCP IP?
Yes, it is. Not exactly. But TCP IP is the protocol. It's pre-web.
No, it was also pre-TCP IP, wasn't it?
Yeah, I guess it is because it's using SMTP. And POP or some other system.
Yes.
Right.
But the federation of all those POP and IMAP servers, and that's kind of one of the cool things, is that not only did you could be on disparate servers, you could be on servers that use different protocols, POP or IMAP or Exchange, and the email would still magically get to where you sent it as long as you knew the address. And that really worked quite nicely, right?
I mean, the problem was this was a different time, right? Like this was 1971 when we were just trying to get the network to work.
Right.
Now there's no company that's financially incentivized to make a federated system. There just isn't.
Right.
There's no reason why any company would say everybody can have an equal copy of the data that we can have. Why?
Twitter doesn't want to do federated. They want to do Twitter. Facebook doesn't want to do federated. They don't want to do Facebook.
Right.
Google doesn't want to do federated. They want to do Google.
Well, I think if you go to the WordPress model, some people thought WordPress.
RSS is federated. RSS was an attempt to create a federated protocol that would cross all of these systems.
Yes.
But people, I think Gina's right. There's no economic incentive to do this.
Well, let me argue the WordPress model. WordPress versus movable type. Right? Movable type said, we own the software, and yes, we'll let it out there, but we're going to limit it because we're going to go into business, and we don't want you to compete with us. WordPress, on the other hand, said, nope, software, open source, stays at the .org, anybody can do it, and we're just the first company to build on top of it. And indeed, it's a great business. Mullenweg has a genius business there where he's built a great business, but I can use the WordPress underlying code, and I can start my own hosting company competing with WordPress.com. And Mullenweg still benefits because I'm going to contribute to the code base.
By the way, we've conflated different OSI levels. TCP/IP is still the protocol on top of which SMTP and POP run. That's simply a communication protocol. Yeah. And then there's an email protocols that are well understood.
Right.
And similarly, WordPress is at a higher level still than that.
All I was trying to suggest there by that was that even before we had broad use, standardized use of net, you could connect MCI mail, which was not TCP/IP, which was, you know, not internet.
Well, we don't know
to
what
other
protocol
mail services through a protocol.
Right.
That's all.
Yeah, there was a gateway. There was a gateway.
Yeah.
But, you know, the best example of this is XMPP, which is a federated protocol. It was a Jabber protocol. Google used it for GTalk. And what did Google do? They killed it. They said, we don't want to support that anymore because exactly as you said, Gina, they have no economic incentive to do that. They have every incentive to create a proprietary protocol that you can only use on Google and not to interoperate with everybody else.
Yeah, I mean, the pattern is kind of you make this amazing client that works with a standard protocol that anybody, you know, can implement, right? But then your client becomes so good and so specialized and so proprietary that after a while you don't support the protocol. I look at GitHub, for example. You know, Git is a distributed version control system, and everyone that runs Git has an equal copy of the data and, you know, GitHub. But GitHub itself is this amazing Git client with a bunch of add-ons, pull requests and social and tagging and user profiles and wikis and website hosting, right? And people love GitHub. This is a great place to collaborate, but it is controlled by one company, but it's based on this open source software, right? Much like WordPress. Now, WordPress has Jetpack, which is their sort of proprietary layer kind of on top of WordPress that that gives you lots of things, site stats and that kind of thing, but it all feeds back to Automattic, which is the the commercial entity on top of. This is ThinkUp's model. I mean, we're an open source software, but we're a hosted, you know, we're a company building a hosted service on top of it because it's too much of a pain to set it up yourself. And that definitely works, but there's definitely a tension between, you know, of course we're building this client, say this IM client, and we're going to have Java support in it, right? Until it gets so big and so good and so proprietary and so embedded into our system that, you know, it's just too much work to support Jabber anymore. You should just use our stuff.
Right.
You know,
because our stuff's better.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm just wishing for some scenario where someone totally reinvents email. Because email.
Well, but okay, I'd say, let me say one thing is that's the application layer. And email, all email is a protocol for exchanging messages using universally accepted canonical addresses. And there's a protocol for saying, I got all the pieces I did. I mean, there's a lot of underlying stuff. The presentation layer is can be anything. That's what Google's doing with Inbox.
It's the client. Mm-hmm.
That's the client. And yeah, so no, I think what you want, Jeff, is a replacement on the presentation layer. I don't think...
No. I'm going to disagree. I want people to not be able to send me anything unless I have approved it.
Well, we've had systems like that as an anti-spam systems for some time. Remember, I used to hate this. You'd get an email from somebody saying, well, Jeff's not accepting email unless you prove you are who you say you are.
Well, but I think
that's annoying, Jeff. You don't want that.
How does Google Plus operate? Right. Google Plus is a model for this. I don't get. And listen to Mike Elgin. Right. Mike Elgin is Dvorak 2.0. Right. Dvorak. I get no spam Dvorak.
Right.
I get no trolls, Elgin.
Right.
Right. So Elgin
was
talking
agree.
About Google Plus in this way.
And that's, by the way, why I've completely moved all my social interactions to Google Plus.
Ah, you see?
He's right.
So the question is, the big complaint about Google Plus is what? Nobody's there. Just our geeky friends.
Just us.
Right.
And everybody with a Gmail account could conceivably be on Google Plus.
Right, but what would make Google Plus explode, opening it up?
I don't want it to explode.
I mean, in my circle of friends, my company, they laugh when I mention Google Plus.
Yeah,
like,
no.
it's a punchline. I mean, really, there's a certain community who's, you know, heavy iPhone Twitter users, you know, who, you know, for whom Google Plus is, you know, some weird, you know, it's a cultural indicator of some like weird Aspie Googler. I'm sorry. I apologize if that's
I like that, though.
Offensive.
I know what you're saying.
I've never heard that phrase before,
but I like it.
I haven't either.
It is a little offensive, but that's okay.
It is offensive.
We all know what you're saying.
I'm actually really regretting saying that. I'm sorry.
I've never heard that before.
You know, but there is something about it. Yeah, I know.
Jeff and I will not let her. No, move on.
Cool.
No, but I find that interesting because I would think everybody you know would understand and love Google Plus.
I come to you on All About Android to be with my people, my fellow Google fans.
Yeah,
but you know, there's a lot of folks out there who aren't about it. You know,
chill
they use
Brooklyn
Gmail, but that's it.
Yeah, and they think Twitter's great.
People love the Twitter. I know. Listen, everybody's got.
The Twitter numbers. All this week I have the top editors from Berta, the big German publisher, with me, and I'm brainwashing them, and we're going around some great tours. And we went visited Twitter. It was a great visit, but the numbers on Twitter, especially let's say in Europe, are really small. WhatsApp is much bigger in a lot of countries.
Yeah.
And what's the deal about WhatsApp? WhatsApp is more recipient control.
That's true. You can't WhatsApp me unless I approve you, right?
Yeah. Right. So maybe WhatsApp is what I'm looking for, even though I don't use it.
But there are a lot of cases where you want somebody you haven't previously approved.
That's what email becomes. That's okay.
So we do
email
keep
is a separate system.
All right. Well, then, Jeff, you don't want to reinvent email. You just want to stop using it.
I want to make it less important to me.
Right. Well, I think inbox is kind of about that. It's kind of about saying, well, here's stuff. Here, if we do this organizational stuff, you can quickly find the stuff that you want to get in email. And all of your more important transactions can happen elsewhere.
Right. Sorry about that.
It'd be nice if actually, if inbox could forward, could say, you seem to be talking to that person a lot. Why don't you go move to WhatsApp? That would be good. That would be good. Should we just change that to a WhatsApp account? And maybe that's what Google needs to do.
That Facebook has WhatsApp and Facebook has Messenger. And I was just saying a few minutes ago that Facebook's not a communications company. Well, right. Facebook is not a communications application. But Facebook is becoming a communications company.
Yeah. And you know what happens is people want me to use Messenger. And some people insist on communicating with me with Messenger. And this is the problem with Messenger, Jeff, because unlike WhatsApp, if you have a Facebook account, you have a Messenger inlet. And so WhatsApp, you have to explicitly say, I'm going to allow that person to share with me. Unless he knows my phone number, he can't. And for Facebook, anybody who has a Facebook account can bother you.
So your canonical address in this world becomes your phone number. And using that, figuring that this is, okay, I see the brilliance of WhatsApp now suddenly. Knowing that everyone has a canonical address,
but
you can build something across that.
But it's not widely known.
Problem. What?
But it's not widely known. Only your friends know it.
But you can choose how it's on my business card. You can choose how to put it out there. You also have some choice whether to accept or not.
Right.
My point is this: Google and Google Plus tried to make everybody get a canonical address called a Gmail address.
Right.
And they finally gave up. WhatsApp more cleverly said, "No. Nobody can make this happen." Which is Gina's point. Nobody's going to build that. There already is a new canonical address. It's the phone number. What can we build on top of that?
And people are saying in the chat room, well, you can WhatsApp anybody you know their phone number. Well, that's the point, is that you control the phone number much more tightly than you do your email address.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we're also speaking as people who publicize our email address a lot
more
than
maybe that was our mistake. Yeah.
I mean, you know, you have to think about the fact that email, electronic mail, was built on the model of like an electronic version of postal mail. Well, if someone has your street address, they can send you a letter, right? But the difference between postal mail and electronic mail is that with postal mail, the onus is on the sender. They have to pay for a stamp. They have to get the envelope. It's a pain. It's a pain to send somebody a letter, right? With email, the onus is on the recipient. It costs so little, and because it's so easy for the sender to send email, if you publicize your email address on websites that get millions of hits versus your postal address in a white pages, you know, you're going to get killed with email.
Here's the easy fix. I don't know why I didn't think of this. Jeff, this is all you do. And many people do this. You have different email addresses. You have a public email address. You have one you give to a close circle of friends, one you only give to intimates.
I have enough trouble dealing with the two I have.
But that's really what you're doing with WhatsApp. You're saying, my phone number is a little bit more secure, so I'm going to use that for the most intimate conversations.
No. Here's why, Leo, here's why I don't think that'll work. Because inevitably, it leaks into the spammer world and it gets ruined.
I have a friend who has solved this. My friend changes his email address yearly. In a regular known fashion, his friends will know what to do each year to change his email address and to be able to get through to him. And he deprecates last year's email address, doesn't use it anymore. It's brilliant.
Oh, what a pain.
But I know, as his close friend, I know how to email him.
But
I'm going to start doing that.
Leo,
I'll whisper to you my secret.
On WhatsApp, not only do you have everything Gina just explained, you also have, at the moment of someone trying to communicate with you, you have the option at that time to say, nope.
Can you block them?
Or you just decline.
Yeah, I think so.
Decline and they can never contact you.
Yeah, I think so, can't you?
But you're just doing you are actually just doing what you could do with an email address, which is have security one and a lower security
WhatsApp.
One.
You can't spam WhatsApp. If your email address leaks out in any way, It will propagate against spam world.
So if your phone number leaks out in any way, you will. The idea is really your phone number is not as easy to use as an email address.
And you will get invitations, but you have the opportunity at that moment to refuse the invitation. Right?
I get it.
Wait, wrong. I don't use WhatsApp, folks. So
that's why WhatsApp is worth $22 billion. Right there, you nailed it.
Yeah, because I'm now seeing the architectural insight into it. And in Zuckerberg's appreciation for it.
this kind of segues the email or the email address versus phone number conversation kind of segues a little bit into the announcements that Twitter made today. Did you guys see they're trying to basically
Let's take a break and talk about those. Yeah. We also have third quarter results for Google. Lots of news, but we are going to take a break now because we're brought to you by a fine company that's up in Canada that we love so dearly. It's called Hover.com. It's a quality service run by nice guys who really protect you. They do the right thing. For instance, they take all the hassle and friction out of registering a new domain name. They know you want Whois privacy. They just include it. They don't give you 50 checkboxes and upsell you five ways from Sunday before you can buy the domain name. Right now is a great time to get a domain name at Hover.com. They've lowered the prices on 200-plus extensions, many TLDs. They've reduced the price for a new .com domain name. It's now $12.99 a year. Whois privacy always included. And that's one of the reasons you can't just kind of you can't compare with it, because they have the best domain name management system, lets you set up DNS, do all the right things. And it's so easy to use. In less than 5 minutes, you'll find the domain name you want, buy it, and get it up and running. They even have a valet transfer service. Not available, but here's some other choices. I highly recommend that when you move to Hover, you let them do it. It's free. They'll take care of the entire process for you. They'll transfer your DNS settings and everything at no additional cost. Then you get all of the benefits of Hover.com. They've got great customer support. They're famous for their no-wait, no-hold, no-transfer phone service. When you call, you will get a representative who is empowered to fix your problem. Not that you're going to have any. They're so good. I've never had to call them. They also offer volume discounts if you're one of those people who likes to register a lot of domains, or you've got a bunch of domain renewals coming up. The volume discounts start at 10 known domains and go up in value from there. You can add email to any of your domains. They have every one of all the weird top-level domains, as well as the .com and .net. I just think they're great. Hover gives you exactly what you need to get the job done with no fuss. Hover.com. 10% off your first purchase when you use our offer code TWIG10. Take advantage of that. TWIG10 at Hover, Hover.com. Just do it. Just do it.
Hover's great.
Yeah, see? Unsolicited.
Hover's awesome. I registered my domain.
We've all suffered so much, and I've moved, you know, God, I keep trying to remember. Who was the first one that everybody used? Can't remember. Anyway.
This is pre-Dead Elephants and NASCAR.
Yeah, pre-Dead Elephants and NASCAR Babes. I admit I had an account with them at one time.
I did too.
And it felt so nice to move over to Hover.
See ya.
Yeah, bye-bye. So what did Twitter just do?
So Twitter
you know,
had
you're going to have to explain this one to me.
Yeah. So Twitter had their first developer conference in several years. It's actually going on today in San Francisco, but they had a live keynote this morning, and they introduced a bunch of stuff. Basically, they're trying a bunch of stuff for developers. Okay. So none of this is really consumer facing yet, but essentially a mobile toolkit of a bunch of tools that help developers embed tweets and sign in with Twitter.
Develop Twitter clients. They're telling them to put Twitter in their application.
Put Twitter in your mobile application. And one of these tools that they introduced is called Digits. And it's their effort at removing email addresses and passwords from signing up for mobile apps. So Twitter product managers kind of traveled the world to do some research on how people use the web and how does Twitter get new users. And one of the things they found is that the farther that you go away from the United States, the less likely it is that someone has an email address. Everyone's mobile phone is the way that they identify themselves. So what Digits does is it's a bit of UX you can embed into your mobile app that lets users sign up for your app using your mobile phone number. So you enter your number that, you know, your app SMSs you an authorization code, you enter the auth code, and you're in, right? Like no email
password,
address, no
nothing.
Account activation. Right, exactly. Exactly. So similar to the way WhatsApp and Yo works. So it just reminded me, because what Jeff was saying earlier was like, oh, right.
This makes sense.
This makes sense.
Gina, but this is a bigger, huge strategy shift for Twitter.
Yes.
And it depends upon developers trusting Twitter. Just notice where you started this saying, well, Twitter hasn't had a developers conference in a few years because the developers would have thrown spitballs at them for the way that it treated developers before. So explain to me what a developer, what you in an app would get out of doing this in your app. And then explain to me what, then Twitter, as far as I can tell, gets to be at the center of things and gets to sell ad revenue and okay, and gets data. Okay. What does the developer get? Why would you build on this?
Yeah, so I mean, this is from what I understand, this is a mobile developer's toolkit. I think that it's still
is this
really
Fabric?
Hard. Yeah, Fabric yes. is part of it.
Is it like Material or Textile?
The idea that Twitter is offering tools, development tools, and SDKs to help mobile developers get particular tasks done in their app, like single sign-on, like embedding a tweet, like getting crash statistics.
Crashalytics, they call it.
Crashalytics is one of the things that they're offering, right? So as a developer,
they should have failalytics.
Does this mean it's hosted by Twitter and you're going through Twitter's services, or does this mean this is just a standard separate from Twitter?
These are like bits of code and that you can embed into your mobile app. That's
an SDK.
That help. So okay. So yeah, it's an SDK. You embed them on your mobile app, and so yes, I mean Twitter is collecting, for instance, your crash reports, and so you log into Twitter to see what those look like. And yes, users maybe are signing in with Twitter, so you're using Twitter's authorization, but that's the same as using sign in with Facebook or sign in with Google. Basically, right. Twitter's trying to make life on mobile developers as easy as possible, and they're trying to make Twitter a central part of any mobile app. And the way that they're trying to do that is to offer these best-in-class developer tools. Now, you know, Twitter's basically said that they've learned a lot developing their own mobile apps, and they want to share what they've learned and the tool sets that they have internally with the developer community. And this isn't unprecedented, right? Like if you look at Bootstrap, and actually Twitter's open sourced and released a lot of different frameworks and things. In fact, I use Bootstrap all the time. It's great. I mean, it's a fantastic framework. They're good at making developer tools. Most developer tools are pretty crappy. So as a developer, you know, this is, you know, attractive to me. You know, maybe they're offering something, you know, for me, something here better than the App Store's crash logs or the Play Store's crash logs. Android is a first class citizen in this effort, from what I understand. Really good tools here for Android as well. So you have Twitter, which is not Apple and it's not Google, right? So it's just kind of this neutral third party, you know, that lets you build you know, add in components to your mobile app that you don't have to code yourself, right? Because the thing is, you're building your app, your app does something, right? But it also needs all these other things, right? It needs sign-in. It needs crash reports. It needs all these little bits of functionality. You don't want to, as a developer, you don't want to spend time on that. You don't want to reinvent the wheel. You don't want to have to do, you know, that for every app that you build. So that's what Twitter is trying to offer.
Twitter's done this before. Didn't they have Bootstrap? Wasn't that...
Yeah, Bootstrap was one of the frameworks that Twitter offers. Yeah, Twitter makes really great developer tools. So as a
what
developer,
does Twitter get out of, if you put in all these things into your app, what is Twitter getting out of it?
Twitter gets more users, particularly with the sign-in stuff.
And they get Twitter in your app.
They get Twitter in your app. They get tons more tweet impressions. They get to control, or they have some say about the way that you're displaying their content. So the way that they're displaying tweets, so when you display a tweet, there's generally functionality shown with it, like favorite, retweet, reply, you know, DM, etc.
Is this even about tweets?
I'm sorry?
Is this even about tweets?
Well, it is, because in fact, what it does is kind of changes Twitter to be an infrastructure. To be what people often thought Twitter would be, like the dial tone of the internet, and it kind of makes it more of that. It's not so much about the public presentation of Twitter as a whole, but how Twitter is used as a communication medium within your app.
Yeah, it makes it a mobile platform company is what it does.
Yeah.
Which is a huge shift, right? So this isn't at all about the consumer product.
It's very interesting.
Yeah, it is.
And
it is.
I like it because, then that eliminates the whole trollish nature of Twitter, because you control the community because it's whoever's using your app.
Okay, hold on. Explain that, Lucy.
Well, right now there's a public-facing Twitter that's everything, right? Whoever you follow and all the garbage that goes into that and whoever ats you and whatever. And it's just a big mound of horse poo with a pony buried somewhere in there.
With a bird flying over it.
Many birds dropping more harspoo. So I would think that this would be, let's say I'm The Voice. Right now on The Voice, what they do is they say vote on Twitter, put hashtag the person's name, and it becomes part of that pile of poo. But a voice app could incorporate this all in it, use Twitter as more of a back-end infrastructure, and surface just the appropriate tweets into the app, making it much more useful for The Voice and its users and viewers, and much less a part of the massive car wreck that is Twitter today. And Twitter still gets the benefit, right? In fact, it's better for them because they now can say to advertisers, hey, by the way, we got all these people using The Voice, and they can monetize it.
Yep.
And what has Twitter's problem been? What were witnessed the other discussion that I had about Germans and Twitter? They need more signups. So they become infrastructural.
Right.
You sign up. All right. Right. So the question you have to ask, and you know, maybe it's because Twitter smokes more now and is nicer, but but if Twitter does what it's done before and pulls the rug out, what happens to your apps?
Oh, this is the grand question of any developer who depends on a third-party service, you know, when they build
and
their app.
This circles back to that discussion of federation versus silo.
It does.
Well, you know, it's the convenience versus risk, you know, the thing that we always, I mean, look, we're, you know, I build an app based on Twitter. We use Amazon Payments. We use Google Analytics. Like, we're dependent on, you know, my company is dependent on all these third-party services that at any moment could change their mind or take it down or block us. And that's just kind of, you know, it's kind of one of the trade-offs that you make when you decide to make an app. Now, Twitter did, in a lot of developers' views, totally screw over the developer community. Marco wrote a post about this. I thought it was a little heavy-handed, personally, but I get it. Like, I get that client makers felt really burned by Twitter doing, you know, kind of a 180 from a very open API to a very limited API. These announcements that they made today are pretty separate than that. They're orthogonal. But, you know, I was at the original Twitter developer conference. I think they did it in, it was called Chirp, and I think it happened in 2010. And at that conference, they announced a thing called annotated tweets, which was a way to pack lots of different information into a tweet, like any sort of metadata that you wanted.
Right. Which was a great idea, and they deprecated it.
It never happened. Yeah, I don't even think it ever launched.
Oh, wow.
So I actually think Fabric is not.
That was treating, by the way, Twitter more like XMPP. That's exactly what XMPP does.
Right. They were trying to figure out a way, hey, we want to push packets across the network and however developers define. I mean, it was a very exciting, big idea. It never really happened. Fabric appears to be less vaporware. I mean, I think you can actually download some of these components and use them now.
I think devs understand this and already are using it by using the Twitter authentication system.
Right.
I don't think this is a risk for a developer that you get all these benefits. And if Twitter goes away, which it doesn't look like it's going to do anytime soon, you do Facebook.
No, it's not about Twitter dying. It's about Twitter changing the rules.
Well, they change the rules and you change to Facebook. I mean, we all have Facebook Connect and Twitter.
Up. But now here's the problem, Leo. And Twitter sign up is extremely convenient. Twitter and Facebook sign up is extremely convenient. Google sign up has never really taken off, but it's there.
Android devices. You use it on like crazy.
But at some point, if I sign in through a service through Twitter, that's where my linkage is. And if Twitter changes the rules or I'm violating Twitter's rules and Twitter pulls back on me or whatever, or my light switch goes off.
It almost feels like Twitter's reinventing itself.
I'm trying to understand that. And I want to trust it. I'm trying to put it in the context of Twitter's culture and behavior previously. I think that's important.
Yeah. Well, maybe they want to turn over a new leaf, Jeff.
Hmm?
Maybe they want to be better now. Maybe they want to turn over a new leaf.
Then that's fine, but they gotta acknowledge the past, and they've got to give us reasons for future trust.
I think Twitter must see the writing on the wall at this point, that the public-facing Twitter has some real problems. Don't you? I mean, it's obvious to me. With the all the harassment in Gamergate, how does it happen? Twitter. This is Arab Spring, blah, blah, blah. Great. But the truth is Google Plus and Facebook don't have nearly the problem that Twitter has with harassment. Twitter has become the channel for harassing people.
Yes.
Yeah. Agreed.
They must know.
How does this fix that? It lets you have a little world maybe for the voice where you see the voice stuff, but that's
people
that's not
use Twitter to create not communities. And it's a form of federation because they're all through Twitter, but it's all owned by Twitter.
So what do I do? So I belong to 100 different Twitter communities?
Well, no, you have a single Twitter sign on. Yeah. And you'll notice when you use an app that has a Twitter interface, hey, good news. And you will see in that app only the stuff that's really germane and apropos.
I'll stop using Twitter. I'll come across Twitter like an Intel chip here and there.
It'll be everywhere.
They hope.
I don't know. Maybe that's wishful thinking on my part.
You have a point, Leo. I think that this is a completely separate issue from the harassment issue. And I like to think that there are going to be developers who say Twitter doesn't make any effort to protect its users or doesn't take enough of an effort to protect its users. So I'm not going to use its tools. I mean, I wouldn't use 4chan sign in.
Kind of like that. And I think Twitter must say, gosh, we're turning into 4chan. Don't you think? God, if they're paying attention, they must be thinking that.
The brand is affected, yes.
How long before the voice says, gosh, we cannot use these Twitter hashtags anymore because our fans are going to Twitter and are going,
I don't know. I wonder if we are a small community of people who are sort of tuned into this happening. I mean, how many people are, friends with an indie game developer who got, driven from her home for threats? Like, yeah. I don't think that many. And Gamergate at this point is so convoluted and we haven't talked about it, but it's tough to understand. Deadspin did an article, which is a sports blog. And, a friend of mine was like, who's a big sports fan, was like, this Gamergate thing, what the hell? And
nobody knows, right.
And it's a 10,000 word article explaining. Right. I mean, I wonder, it's a big deal to me and it's a big deal to us because we care about these things. But I wonder if it really is. Does Twitter really know how bad it is? I don't know. I mean, they haven't even verified Anita Sarkeesian's Twitter account. She's got tons and tons of accounts that are clearly impersonating her. Ripping her profile and her cover photo, and like the whole reason why verification exists is to address the
and they're not even doing
issue.
That.
And they're not even doing
they're
that.
Not even I mean, doing that, and it doesn't do any good when you look at the imposter site, and what are you expected to do? To do a background research on all these Twitter accounts to find the right one? The green check doesn't mean crap.
I just feel like if a normal person, first of all, no normal people probably don't use. My mom isn't going to use Twitter. But let's say my mom goes to Twitter.com, signs up, and, of course, Twitter does its best to do the intake and give her some interesting stuff to follow. Mm-hmm. But she starts seeing streams, and maybe she starts following people. It doesn't take very long before maybe it's not even offensive. It's just chaotic, and it's a strange culture. It's weird. Right? And there's weird abbreviations. It's just, it feels like a...
Leo, then why... But why
lots of in-jokes.
It's still tiny and all that, but why does every weather person in America push their Twitter mm-hmm. stuff? Why do all these big shows push Twitter? But
well,
now
you
to
tell
your
me
point,
why
has it not taken off more than
well, you tell me why. Why are they all using hashtags? Why does every show use a hashtag?
And Twitter's not mass.
Yeah, but that's why I'm wondering. Why?
Yeah, I don't know why. I'm agreeing with you. Here's my bottom line.
Chad's going to tell us why, because he's under 50.
There's no other service that does that real-time public posting.
Well, that's why I think Fabric is important, because Twitter recognizes that it does have a lock on a certain market. And mm-hmm. what it's looking at is better ways to provide that service for individual communities that will be more appealing to communities, that will eliminate the heat it's getting from things like Gamergate. That's why I think Fabric would make sense as a strategic shift for Twitter, and who knows what they what they're doing.
Here's my issue with
Twitter. I don't claim any understanding of what they're up to. But it's like IRC. What if people wander into an IRC channel? Not ours is pretty well protected. We have lots of mods and stuff, but just a normal IRC channel.
That's what if you wander into a Reddit or a 4chan?
Or Reddit or 4chan. Yeah, exactly. So if you're trying to be a mainstream business and get the approval and appreciation of Wall Street, you got to start thinking about how do we present better.
Okay, but this goes back to our email discussion then, Leo. So then Twitter has two options. One, which they avoided until the ISIS videos, would be to try to censor the content. Governments try to make them do that and so on and so forth. Nearly impossible. You cannot stay ahead of it. But maybe they do, in which case it's no longer an open platform. It's no longer an open stream. Ferguson might not bubble up anymore. Governments can control it more. Which is Twitter? Is it open? In which case, if it's open, this is the discussion we've had, I think it inevitably fosters incivility and trolls. If it's not open, then it's not Twitter and it's not as useful. That's the Hobson's choice they have.
Google announced its financial results for the quarter ending September 30th. Revenue up 20% year over year, $16.5 billion. Let's see, net income, $2.81 billion. It's nice. 3 months, you make almost $1 billion a month. That's good. That's good. That's a good business. It's a nice little business. The Motorola stuff, the sale to Lenovo kind of, you know, messes things up a little bit. I don't know when they're going to close that. They entered that agreement, believe it or not, in January. And there is a charge of $378 million related to a patent licensing royalty asset acquired in connection with Motorola. They're writing off the patent library. Anything else? I'm looking at international revenues. $9.55 billion, more than half of all revenues outside of the United States.
Cue the tax battle.
They actually broke out their United Kingdom revenues because that's the Irish, the double Irish. And they said 10% of total revenues went to the UK. What they did, for those who have not been following this story, they set up a subsidiary in Ireland that collects they licensed the search technology to them. They collect their search revenues, and then but then none of the money gets taxed in Ireland, and then gets transferred to the Canary Islands or somewhere, Bermuda. Cost per
sounds
click
shady, but completely legal.
Cost per click went down completely legal for now. Cost per click went down 2%.
That's the big issue.
Yep. They're making less money on banner ads. However, aggregate paid clicks, which included clicks related ads served on Google sites and sites of network members, increased 17%. So the cost went down, but so many more clicks, they made more money.
But is there a limit to that volume?
Yeah. Well, interesting.
There's a post that somebody sent us on Twitter that I put up on the bottom of the Google section of the rundown, asking whether what's the phrase I want? We've hit where'd it go?
Peak Google.
Peak Google. Yeah,
and I don't actually agree with it. You mean it's all downhill from here? Is that what they're saying?
Well,
it's Ben Thompson. He's going to be on Twit on Sunday. We'll ask him about it.
Oh, nice. Duke.
Yeah.
I think, for example, he's arguing that mobile is now bigger than web, and Google was web, and it's mobile, and so. But Google, I think, is conquering mobile as well as anyone. He's also arguing that native advertising takes over search advertising. I don't think native advertising joins the world. Takes over the world, because I think it's a fake on users, and I think that attention, according to Chartbeat, is where we go, and I think relationships is where we go, but. You know, Google's not invincible, and Google knows it.
Well, in a way, what he's saying is web search, which was Google's business, is going to be replaced.
Yeah, but Google already is a mobile company.
Yeah,
and Google already is the best at generating signals. Google is a personal services company, so I think it's a little simplistic to say they were a search company still. They haven't been a search company in years.
It's no accident that you've seen on the World Series and the playoffs and everywhere else. Ads for Android for the first time ever. Not for a Google phone or a Google device, not for Chrome, not for search, for Android. I think Google knows the future is mobile. And I think they have a pretty credible thing they're going with that Android. I think that Android going somewhere.
Yeah.
Just my guess. I don't know. We'll ask Ben. That's good. That's an interesting.
It'll be an interesting discussion.
Yeah. Yeah.
And his blog post is sponsored So there you go. A mandrel actually, but it's not a banner mandrel. Ad. It looks integrated into his blog theme. So, I think you know, we've talked about native advertising and we've talked about how it can be confusing to the reader, or the viewer, or the right. listener. But I think that, you know, a lot of people really think native advertising is the best thing, right?
Because it tricks people. It's so effective.
So effective.
You know, the best thing is fooling people. We find ads work so much better when they look like editorial.
I was at the New York Times today with the Borda editors, and they showed off a lot of the native advertising we've seen. We've talked about the Orange is the New Black and so on and so forth. It finally dawns on me what it's about, is that native advertising, besides selling some of your brand value to your advertisers and letting readers think that this is appearing on your site, even though they put labels up, that's the real goal on one hand. The other hand is that advertising has been, Google's been a part of this, completely and absolutely commodified. So you have to sell something special to an advertiser. You got a few choices. You could sell them your special relationship with your users, but you don't have such a thing. Google does, but you don't in media because everybody's the same. It's a mass. Or you can sell them special content that we made for you. Aren't we nice? And so it's an effort to decommodify advertising, but it's expensive. It doesn't perform that well. Chartbeat has also found that people scroll 3/4 of the time with real content, and only 1/4 of the time when they hit native advertising.
So they know. People intuitively know they're reading crap.
Exactly. Is it possible to do native advertising that has an interesting piece? Yeah. But if people won't read a 4-word banner ad, why do we think they're going to read a 600-word native ad?
Only if they don't know it's an ad.
Yeah.
If they think it's content, they might go for it.
So subtle you don't know it's an ad, then is it an ad?
What you said, Orange is the New Black, that's native content? Is it brought to us by the color orange?
Look it up. The New York Times did a story about women in prison.
Oh, Jesus.
Pegged to Netflix.
To learn more about women in prison, there's a fabulous show on Netflix.
Bingo.
Oh, my God.
New York Times story?
Look at this. It says paid post. Those of you who are watching at home, see if you can figure out where it says paid post. It says it right. Well, it's obvious. It's right here in this little light blue. There it is.
Well, but Leo, it also uses sans serif type. Isn't that enough of it?
There it is. It's obviously a paid post. Ooh, I like
that.
Ooh, pretty.
Who wrote this? Did the Times write this piece?
No, a business side writer wrote this. It's very well done.
It's like got all that fancy new media stuff that New York Times.
The videos are good. The interviews are good. I mean, it's well done. But if you're a reader of the Times, you have to ask, if this story is so good, why didn't editorial do it?
In an August op-ed in the New York Times, Piper Kerman, author of the prison memoir Orange is the New Black, which inspired the Netflix series of the same name, calls the distance between... Boy, that's just horrible. Horrible.
That is being argued over and over and over. Our industry is the future. Now, Leo, of course, they'll say, well, it's no different from you reading a spot.
Well, we say, here comes an ad. There goes an ad. And that ends the relationship with the advertiser. Doesn't bleed into editorial.
I agree. But that's the model. You try to say it looks compatible with the environment.
Look, it's the Times brand studio that did it. Look here.
I mean, from a web perspective, the images as you scroll and stuff is really
cool. Beautifully done because they can afford to.
Because they can afford to do it.
Because Netflix gave them $1 million.
Check the URL.
The URL is paidpost.newyorktimes.com/Netflix.
Okay.
They make no bones about that, but who reads that?
Yeah.
They're trying
to put signals out to make sure that there's some caveat at the bottom. Look at the bottom of the story.
It's funny because Apple in its Safari browser would cut that all out except for the New York Times part, but okay.
Subdomain? What subdomain?
Just some domain. It's on the Times.
And if you go to Forbes, of course, Forbes has made an entire business of what they call brand voice.
So, yes, when we've talked about that before. So this is, for the most part, except for that paragraph I read, good content.
Yeah, it actually is.
So the content's there. So it's almost this is. Although there's here's, I mean, is this a clip from the show Orange or is this
No, see, these are interviews.
These are real people. It looks like a clip from the show.
Yeah, they went and spent a lot of... Well, here's the other thing. They spent a lot of money to make this. Now, of course, they charged the sponsor for all that money.
Yeah.
I think it strengthened my character.
Does this...
And made me a better person being in there.
Does this make you watch the show? And is this in some way deceptive? I mean, if the editorial content were slanted somehow to... I mean, the only thing is that they have this segment that is Piper Kerman, the author of Orange Is the New Black,
right?
And then they move on. And she was in women's prison. I mean, it's not like she doesn't have some standing.
No, they showed another one from United about United taking all of the athletes to the Olympics, and they said United has some data about this that only United has.
Right.
United has stories, but this only United has. We're just helping them tell their story.
Now, how does this appear? The other question would be, how would I get to this? Does this appear as a story in their story?
There's if you go to the homepage of the New York Times,
yeah,
right underneath the whole big main news, there's a coaster of, I don't know, a half dozen boxes across. Scroll down until you don't stop. Now keep going. Stop. Right. Stop. In that inside nytimes.com, if there was one, there isn't right now, they would have it in there. And
it'd be one of these.
It would say paid post. And it would be there.
And it would say paid post.
Yeah. And they'll sell ads, I believe. They'll sell ads on the Times to drive traffic to the Post. So they're selling media in that sense.
I mean, I have to say this is – it's hard to find who's damaged by this.
Yeah. I mean, I'm somehow not really offended by that because it's like, you know, the show actually is about trying to raise awareness and trying to create prison reform. People care about this now. This actually looks like a well-researched article with great, great assets. Like, does that hurt anyone? I mean, it offends me when it's done really badly. But, you know, it's the same thing, right?
I think it's fine as long as you know. If the reader knows what we need more research, and I think they're doing that research now, I asked today, and the industry needs to, on whether readers are indeed fooled. Now, if you listen to, and I feared that they were, but if you listen to Chartbeat, they say, well, actually, no, people recognize it's crap, but they don't scroll.
Well, that might be when it's really crap. This is well-done content.
It's well-done.
I have to say, data. I would feel a lot better about it if this paid post indicator were a little bit more obvious.
I agree.
That is very hidden on the whole
thing. Well,
here's
the scary part, Leo.
Well, it's competing with that giant, you know, header image there.
Yeah.
The Interactive Advertising Bureau and Edelman did some research that I hosted their announcement of it, or panel at their announcement of it, two months ago or so. And what they found was that in entertainment sites and lifestyle sites, people pretty much knew the difference. They could, given a site, they could say, that's an ad, that's not, that's an ad, that's not. They could do it only half as well on news sites.
Yeah, this looks like
that's
news.
Where the harm comes in.
So now, everybody's seen this. I mean, for crying out loud, my local paper has had a paid real estate section as long as I've been alive, where, you know, your local realtor writes a column on why it's a good time to buy a house.
And the auto section.
And this is not new.
No. Here's the issue. And the example I gave when we discussed Forbes. When I see a Forbes link on Twitter now, it could be excellent content by a Forbes staffer, and they have really good stuff. It could be very good content by a Forbes contributor. It could be crappy content by a Forbes contributor, or it could be a really long and wordy ad. I don't know which it is when I click. And when I get there, I see something labeled Brand Voice, and next to that it says, what's this? Well, if you have to put a link to say, what's this? Obviously, the label ain't good enough.
Right.
So in the long run, I think that publishers risk their brands, their trust, their equity.
Well, I wouldn't do it, but that's more because I'm an old fuddy-duddy.
But now what happens is the Times has to say, the Times puts itself in a position where, and they will, and they reject ideas for native ads. They won't do them. They have to hold them to a standard.
Good.
I heard another publisher this week say that the editorial staff is asking the ad department to do better native advertising, so it holds up. But at some point, what that says is it's being seen as part of your brand. And so you become responsible for your advertising in a way you weren't before. All I'm suggesting is it's not the future of all advertising, because I can't see consumers reading 1,000-word pieces and just getting the subliminal message that I feel like watching some women in prison.
We have the Google change log coming up in just a little bit, but first, an ad from our friends at SmartThings. You know, I don't know what the difference is.
Have you listened to Alex Blumberg's podcast about making a podcast company?
No, I have to listen to that.
You really have to. And the funny thing is, he goes out of his way to do this, and he plays special little music when he goes into the ad, and he explains, that's how you know I'm in the ad. I'm going to explain this to you. But you, of all people, should listen to that. And I'm sorry I'm doing this now over the...
No, I should third. I should actually. Yeah. Paul Harvey used to do that. He'd go, page two. And unless you were in the clue, you didn't know, but that's what that meant is, this is an ad. I mean, I think always... it's always the case that when hosts read ads, there's a little bit of... One of the reasons they want hosts read ads is a little bit of confusion.
I don't know. It's just you can't escape it. It's part of the flow.
Yeah.
All right.
I don't know. I wish I didn't have to make money. I wish I were independently wealthy and I could just do this whole thing.
Wait. If you were independently wealthy, would you really be working as hard as you're working?
Well, I wouldn't be doing three or four shows a day. No, but I... But I might do one show a day just in a leisurely fashion in my jammies. Yes. I like doing it. It's not that I don't love doing these shows.
Yeah.
We employ 20 people, full-time staff, and another several dozen hosts like you guys. We pay you guys to be here. Not a huge amount, but you get something. And all that money comes from advertising. It's the only source of revenue. We get a little bit of money from people who donate. Thank you, donors. But really, mostly it's from advertising. And so that's how it works. But if I had a couple hundred million, if I were Steve Ballmer, I might just do this for fun. Pay you guys. I told Kevin Rose, really, basically, I'm paying to have some friends. Otherwise, I'd be lonely. Our show today brought to you by SmartThings. And this was a Kickstarter project. In fact, Gina told me that she actually invested in it. The whole idea of which was to solve the problem of how do you automate your home. There's like all these different protocols. Nobody talks to anybody else. So the smart folks at SmartThings said, what if we made a hub that talked to everything and then you wouldn't need to worry about it? You just put the hub in your home, connect it to the internet, and then start getting little solution kits or security kits and adding features. They have all sorts of doohickeys that work with the SmartThings. And then the SmartThings Hub also works with other companies' stuff, like the Sonos, which I love, the Wemo from Belkin's, those great LED lights from Philips, the Hue, the DropCam, we use those, Nest thermostats, or Eon, or Honeywell, or Schlage locks, or GE. So this way, you've got kind of this infinite capability of stitching things together. You can use if this, then that, if you want to have, you can even write little programs, in effect, that connect these. SmartThings has three smart home security kits, because that's one of the things people first want to do. So they came up with those right away. You get the hub plus devices to know if there's motion in your home or if somebody's opened a door, that kind of thing. They've also got something new, which I really like. These are the solution kits. There's four of them, and they help you achieve common goals like automating lights or saving energy, or protecting your home from leaks, that kind of thing. Oh, and if you're an Arduino maker, there's a maker kit that will let you connect your Arduino projects. Now the sky is really the limit. Every kit starts with a SmartThings hub and then has the sensors and devices you'll need to turn your home into a smart home in, as little as 15 minutes, including the new improved updates to the SmartThings Zigbee sensors. Zigbee is a very common home automation protocol, and they do Zigbee better than anybody now. But the really powerful thing about SmartThings, it's an open platform. That means because it's compatible with hundreds of devices, there are thousands of things you can do with this product. They have an iOS and Android app, one app, limitless possibilities. To get started creating your smart home, visit smartthings.com/twit, and we'll give you 10% off the purchase price of any home security or solution kit if you use the offer code TWIT10 at checkout. 10% off. When you use TWIT10 at checkout on any home security or solution kit at smartthings.com/twit. And you also get free shipping in the U.S. smartthings.com/twit. I'm not exactly handy. And I was able to set these up and make them work with my Hue lights and the Wemo. And it's so neat. And I love my Sonos. Sonos welcomes me home. With Hail to the Chief every time I go. It's so nice. Wouldn't that be great? I should do that, actually. All right. Speaking of trumpets, it's time for the changelog. Play those trumpets.
The Google changelog.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Gina Trapani with the newest stuff from Google.
Google Play Music adds song says, can you hear me okay? Yeah, you can.
Yes, I'm just making funny faces.
Good. Google Play Music adds song says contextual playlists for all access subscribers and using the new Material Design UI, which we're going to see a lot of in the changelog in the coming weeks. So that means if you're a Google Play Music all access subscriber in Google Play Music on Android, iOS, and on the web, you'll see a brand new section in the Listen Now area that's basically a take on song says concierge functionality. So like depending on what time of day it is or what you're likely to be doing at the moment, Play Music will show you a list of possible sort of playlists or stations you'll want to listen to, like working out, getting ready for work, studying, sleeping. You know, hey, it's Wednesday afternoon. Do you want some, you know, do you want to work to the beat? Do you want to boost your energy? Do you want to relax? And it offers you kind of a list of playlists. I've been playing with this today. It's pretty great, I gotta say. Look at that, the blogged 50. I like that. Read all the music blog, all the music blog songs that you'd want.
I gotta say, I'm a huge fan of Google Play Music, and I have all access. And when I saw this come in, I was so excited because
it's
discovering music is the best thing to do when you have unlimited music, and this makes it very simple.
Yeah, it's really, really great. I mean, and, you know, we were looking at this last night on All About Android, and it was so funny. You know, Jason has young kids like me, and he had, you know, family and toddler tunes, you know, and Ron is a, you know, single guy, hangs out with his friends, and all of his suggestions for a Tuesday night were like going out to dinner, hanging with your friends. Like, you know, we were commenting how scary it was that it knew so much about our lives.
If you look at mine, it has working to the beat, having fun at work, boost your energy. It seems like I work too much.
But that's the songs of stuff. It always had stuff like that.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. But it knows. So it knows what time of day it is, what you're likely to be doing based on, you know, earlier choices. It's all about, it's basically Google Now for music. So it's pretty great.
They bought songs a while ago. This is,
They just started integrating
it. I love Google Play Music. The more I use it, the more I love it.
I have to say, this feature really, yeah, I was thinking of my All Access subscription. I like it. I was thinking about maybe canceling. I'm in. I'm good.
I know there's now Spotify and Beats looks more and more interesting. You got a lot of choices.
There are a lot of choices out there. Yeah. It's true. This one, Leo, I wonder if you must have talked about this with Steve. Google beefs up its two-step verification with a physical USB security key option in Chrome.
Yes.
So basically this is second, you know, two-factor authentication, of course, is your password, but then this other thing that you have, a physical thing that you have. Normally, it's your phone. You know, you get your authorization code on your phone or via SMS. This is an actual USB key that supports a standard for this kind of authentication that you can plug in. If with this enabled in Chrome, you plug into your computer and Chrome knows, yes, this is you. Ah, you have one.
This is from YubiKey. They've made these keys for a while. And this is Neo. Is it FIDO that Google is supporting? Is that
FIDO? FIDO. Yeah. FIDO, I ordered one yesterday when they announced this.
Yeah. So this is the Neo. The idea is you leave this in your USB port. And it just checks it. I worry about this because I'm afraid of losing my dongle.
Right, right. And
that was my question for you, Gina. Does your phone still work? Because your phone doesn't have a USB.
Right. It's a good question. I haven't actually tried this myself. Leo, do you know? Does the phone still work, or is the USB is just for your computer? And do I need one for each individual device?
You could. I mean, both of these have little holes that you could put it on a lanyard or something and carry it around your device with you.
Well, because you'd want it in case you want to put it into a work computer and then leave, or someplace else and then leave.
Right. But then what about when you're on the road? Would Authenticator still work? I don't know. I would love it if it did. And I just don't know.
When I spoke to the work people, head of.
Wait a minute. Let me look. It says use a verification code instead right there on the verification screen. So that means you could either have your security key in there or You could go to your authenticator and use the code anyway. Right.
And they were acknowledged. The head of security gave a fascinating talk, and he said, "Yeah, we acknowledge that not many people use two-step," and he said, "We'll soon have something." I presume this is it that they thought would get more people to use it. My guess is that you get to tell me if I'm wrong. NFC on your phone operates in essence like that. It says, "I'm me." And I can see Google doing other hardware things that will help in this besides having a wonky USB device.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Dr. Mom. Dr. Mom just said in the chat room that the key has NFC, so you can use it with your
this
phone.
This one does. This one doesn't, right?
Oh, okay. So yeah. Some keys which, do.
Some do, some don't.
Depending that's why the difference in price, because they go from $4 to $50.
Yeah. Yeah. The little one does not. It's too small. And the big one does. But there's more than that. I mean, so these are from Yubico, Y-U-B-I-C-O, and we like them.
Now, how does that work? Does that just have one special number and it says I'm a hardware thing so you know I'm really real?
No, it actually has a processor in here and does calculations. So it gets queried, but it's my understanding. Steve did talk about this on Tuesday, but I was sleeping. It gets queried. I was trying to pay attention. I didn't understand it. That's the problem. It gets queried and makes some calculations and comes back with a response, I believe, or is used by the computer to do the calculations. So there is a processor in this, believe it or not.
Oh.
Yeah, isn't that wild?
What if you lose it or it breaks?
Well, that's point, is then you use your verification code.
Use Authy or, right.
I'll tell you what, before next week, I will set this up and start using it.
Sweet. We got you on inbox. We got you on.
I am set.
I have one arriving from Amazon like tomorrow, so I'm going to try it too.
Good. Okay, good.
Sweet. Cool. Changelog. What else we got? Oh, Google Earth for Android got some updates, including new 3D rendering technology, faster updates, and some KML updates. So first, we got the new 3D technology. This gives users, this is Google Earth for Android, faster, smoother, crisper transitions as you zooming around to your destination. And Google says it's the first major 3D overhaul since Earth launched. It's more than 10 years ago now. God, I can't believe Earth is so old. Old.
How much do you use Earth?
What's that?
You use Earth?
I haven't because Earth was kind of slow.
Maps replaced it, didn't it?
And I was using Maps. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Maps kind of replaced it. So I think they're trying to make Earth relevant again with this update. This update it's going to get updated faster, Google says. Google said the new Earth app will get updates at the same time as Google Maps to add access to the most up-to-date information for things like place names, roads, and businesses. So I might spend a little bit more time with it if it's faster. And, Earth to me was always, hey, I want to fly around and like explore. Whereas Maps was always, I need to get somewhere. Tell me how to do it. Right. So it was more of a utility than anything else. The new Earth updates also introduces support for opening KML files for custom maps directly from Google Drive. So that's kind of nice. You can store your KML in Google Drive and open them up in the new Earth app for Android. Finally, Google Play Games added new nearby multiplayer capabilities to make it easier to play with your friends nearby. So this is actually for developers. This is a part of the Google Play Games API, and it lets developers more easily create like synchronized challenges. If Jeff and I are in the same room, I can challenge him to a game and sync up players at the same time. And it's similar to the functionality on the Nintendo 3DS. So hoping to see more nearby game playing come to your favorite games on Android soon.
Neat.
And that's all I got.
That, my friends, if you'll play the drums slowly, is our Google
In the chat room, Cool Breeze. Who was it? Somebody Breeze.
Some guy.
Cool Breeze just put up a link to YubiKey comparisons of features.
Yes, they have all the different kinds of
For those
keys.
Who want to see.
What did you buy, Jeff? You didn't get a YubiKey?
I don't even remember. I don't know which one I bought.
So what I have is the Neo N. So you want something that supports U2F. That's the Fido technology.
Mm. Now you tell me. Oh, yeah, I got Fido.
You got Fido. If you got Fido, you're good. And so the blue one that I showed is a Fido Touch Key. And then the Neo N, which is... So the Fido Touch Key, even though it's bigger, is $18. And the Neo N is $60. That's touch one-time password generator smart card, and it supports other protocols like Java Card and so forth. There's a lot of protocols. It also, Google points out that the reason you'd want to do this is you can't get spoofed by a phisher who might grab your text messages somehow and get the authentication code. Or, I mean, if you have it on your phone as authenticator, I think you're probably okay. I bet you businesses would like this because you could give, you know, you could say, all right, this is your Chrome. This is your laptop. This is your chip. Put that in there. Only you can use it. Take the chip home with you or something like that, right? A physical thing like that.
Hand in your chip, Mr. LaPorte.
Yeah, hand in your chip. Exactly. Yeah. Business likes hand in your chip. So, and it, yeah, if you, yeah, so that's a good page. It shows you all the different kinds of stuff.
So you got this $18 one?
If you lose your phone, you're okay. If you lose your chip, you're okay. If you lose both, you're screwed.
Yeah, I guess.
But it gives you more than
You know what I do? I put the... So the way you get Authenticator to work, and by the way, this is a standard. It's not just Google's. There are other companies that make Authenticator, including Authenticator apps, including Microsoft. But the way all these apps work is they need your secret key, which is issued to you by the company that you're logging into. Most of the time, they do that in a QR code, right? And so the Authenticator lets you take a picture of the QR code, so you don't have to enter in this 30-digit key. And then that says, oh, yeah, that came from... LastPass, and that's this. And so I'm going to now start generating numbers based on that secret key. The secret key, the number is a hash, is some hash of the secret key and the time. And the reason that that works is because you don't share that. It's secret. So only LastPass and I know the secret key. We both know roughly what time it is pretty accurately. So LastPass knows based on my secret key hashed with the time, what six-digit number I'm going to give it. If they match, I must be the holder of that secret key. But, you know, if that secret key leaks out, you're in trouble. What I do is I actually put those QR codes for Google. I use Google, Tumblr, Evernote, Outlook, LastPass in my LastPass secure store. I save the image. So even if I lose my phone, it's only because I use so many phones, right? Every time I get a new phone, the first thing I do, set up Authenticator on that phone. And because I'm using the same QR code, the same secret number each time, I get the same numbers on all those phones.
The industry's got to make all this easier.
It's easy. Yeah. What's so hard?
I really like Authy.
Authy's a very good one. I've used Authy, yeah.
And I want, you know, and I'm glad you explained that, Leo, because I wondered, I was like, how does Authy know?
Right.
But so this is just a standard. This is
it's
just a
standard.
Key and the timestamp. And that's why they're time dependent. That's why the clock counts down. Okay.
That's right.
That helps. That helps a lot. Thank you for that explanation.
I hope I'm right. Again, I drift off during security now, and I may miss the gist of it. Yeah, Authy is not from Google, but it works. You'll get the same number that Google would give you.
Right, an authenticator. An authenticator. I find Authy just a little nicer looking than Authenticator.
Maybe I'll switch to Authy. I've used it on non-Android platforms.
Yep.
Okay. Hey, anybody order a Nexus 9?
Nope.
Me neither.
My phone's
tablets are over. No, they're not.
It's too big for my pocket. I like my 7.
This giant phone. You got the 7, yeah.
Yeah, I still have the 7. I don't use it. I haven't used it in ages.
I use it constantly.
Use it on the train, is that why?
I use it on the train and on planes, yep.
So it's travel.
I'm going to get Lollipop.
Next Wednesday, who's ordering a 6?
October 29th, apparently, the order date. I will get up early in the morning to order a 6.
I've bought too many phones this year already. I want to. I've bought too many phones. I've been through 2 HTC Ones, and now I got the OnePlus. I just can't justify.
No, you can't.
And honestly, it's just a little too big for me.
It's really big. 6 inches.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They're going to still sell the Nexus 5. I thought that was interesting. So it's pretty clear what the strategy, and we hypothesized this last week. The strategy is the developer platform, the cheap, you know, Lollipop phone will be Nexus 5. And Google's actually going to sell the Nexus 6 as a real feature phone through all the carriers and all of that at a steep price.
Yep.
$650. I'm ready to buy it. It looks like I'm not clear. It looks like it does everything the Moto X does. Does it do the always listening and the...
Does?
Yeah.
It does. It does the OnePlus One thing where you can tap the screen and it turns on.
I saw that. That's Lollipop.
Yeah.
Lollipop lets you tap the screen.
You know, I was saying this on All About Android last night, and you said last week you think Cyanogen is the best Android. I'm really surprised and, you know, it was so interesting to me how many features that are in Cyanogen made it into Lollipop.
Yep.
Like, clearly Cyanogen is this like bleeding edge thing, and Google's paying attention, or they're mind melding. I don't know what they're doing, but it just seems like there are just certain features and I'm like, oh yeah, that's already in Cyanogen. And now that's going to be part of the default. It's nice.
I still think the OnePlus One is great. I gave mine to the Catholic Church, so I don't have to use it anymore.
Padre,
yeah. You're not allowed to give him anything. It's always to the church, and then they let him use it. I think. I don't know. I said, you want my phone? He said, yeah. But I do like the OnePlus.
They'll get you every time, those vows of poverty.
It's a nightmare. Poor guy. No, I think he's actually doing
pretty
well.
So what are you using right now?
Nexus 4, Note 4, which I'll talk about in a second. Okay. And then the real question is going to be what happens. Now, this is 5.7 inches. The real question is going to be what happens. I have to order Nexus 6. It's my job.
It's your job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Chad, you went iPhone 6.
I went iPhone
6, rather.
6 Plus.
Nut.
And I'm
nut.
I am.
You not? No regrets?
I don't know yet.
Miss an Android yet?
I'm going to wait until you get it. I'm worried that 6 is the half inch that pushes over to.
Yeah.
It's an inch away from the Nexus 7.
That,
I mean,
extra
it's
half inch.
So close.
Yeah.
Yeah, although, Chad, in
but
photos.
That way, but just look at the comparison of these two.
Right? Yeah,
this is a 5. I'm not sure it's going to feel that way.
You're right. The 7 does
have a bezel. The 1+1, which you're holding up there, that's a 1+1, right?
Yeah,
that's 5.5 inches. That's the same size as the 6+.
You said if you guessed this would look like a 5 to a 9.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing that's hard to understand, like for instance, this Note 4, which has a bigger screen than your 6+, is a smaller phone because they're big bezels.
Absolutely. Basically, I am holding out till you have it in your hand.
I will bring you the Nexus 6. You
exactly.
can look at it, and you'll say, I'll take that.
Exactly.
Thank you very much.
And then I'm hoping that the resale value of the 6 Plus is good enough if I decide to jump ship on iOS.
The Nexus has a couple of things. It has dual front-facing speakers. That's nice.
Really nice.
Yeah. Out of the features of the iPhone that I'll miss, I will so miss Touch ID.
Yeah, Touch ID is awesome.
And it seems like they're doing Apple Pay right.
Now, wait a minute, though. You'll still be able to touch and pay with the Nexus 6 or the Note 4. The Note 4 does, in fact, have a fingerprint reader, which works. It's not quite as good as Apple's, but it gets the job done.
It still needs a button, huh?
Yeah, you have to swipe it. And it does mean you have a physical button, which I'm not crazy about, but you swipe it. And by the way, applications like LastPass use it. So I swipe, and it unlocks. So I no longer have to enter that PIN in LastPass or the password. I swipe and unlock. So I wonder how long before Google starts doing that. You know, Apple bought the company that it uses, Authentic, and they seem to have the best technology. Samsung is kind of more like those old Lenovo laptops. You have to swipe across it. Anyway, I'm going to talk more about this in my pick of the week. So I don't want to preempt myself. Let's see what else. Some people are starting to see the Nexus 6 now, I guess, but we won't be able to order it to the end of the month, and I'm not sure when it'll arrive at that point. I have to say, given the number of people saying, I'm going to buy one, it may be in short supply. Be prepared. Lollipop, we're starting to see.
Come on the 29th.
Pre-order on the 29th.
What time of the day will that probably happen?
Midnight. I'm going to log in at midnight and every hour thereafter.
Midnight, California time.
I don't know. No, Google is not like Apple. Apple says midnight and then doesn't do it. Google doesn't say a time and then just does it whenever they get around to it. Right? I'm trying to remember other pre-orders. You just kind of have to keep checking.
I might be in Madrid.
Oh. You want me to buy you one?
I might need that. We'll see.
Okay. You just tell me and I'll buy two if you need to. I presume I can get two. Blue. They come in midnight blue or moonlight white. Or something like that.
Basically. I don't want the white. Are you going to buy the 64?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so will I.
Yeah, you got to have the most memory you can get. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
So we're starting to see more about Lollipop. That's the negative on something like the Note 4. And the positive on this Nexus 6 is you're guaranteed to have Lollipop faster than anybody else. See, I like that phone. I think that looks just like a Moto X on steroids.
It does.
Swollen up Moto X. Without the fancy colors and the wood and the bamboo.
The first reviews are also saying the camera is really good.
Well,
that's what they're saying.
Yeah, but remember, they're comparing it to the Nexus 5. So, wow, it looks like the thing I took a picture of. Yeah. Notice this hands-on. This is the Verge's hands-on. Dieter Bohn wrote.
You don't see any hands.
I don't think he. I'm wondering. This seems like maybe at an event he had a hands-on. I don't think he has the phone yet.
A whale of a phone.
A whale of a phone. Codename Shamu. This is the ad that you're seeing for it and all that stuff. I think it looks pretty nice. We'll see. I want Lollipop.
Yeah, I do too.
They are offering. Google's got a little bit of a problem because remember they moved everybody to Hangouts, but they still have to offer a Messenger app. So they will continue to have a Messenger app, a stock SMS app in the Lollipop as well as Hangouts.
Yeah,
which is weird, but I think they have to.
Yeah,
There is an opt-in kill switch in Lollipop, not default opt-in. The new Gmail 5.0, which, as we mentioned, will handle all accounts. The new Google Play Store 5.0, which is already out for some people. Some people have that.
Yeah, I don't have it yet.
No, I don't either. What else is going to be new? This material design, have you been playing with that at all? I mean...
You know, I haven't installed the preview images or anything, so I haven't had a chance. I haven't played with it. It's the thing. I mean, I think it's the biggest, most noticeable change, I think, you know, is that everything's gonna look different and be faster and sort of seem spring-loaded.
It looks pretty snappy. You see how fast that window's moved on that video?
Yeah. Last night we had on one of the lead developers on Tumblr on their Android app, and he was saying that, you know, on other versions of Android, Tumblr's scroll mechanism was sort of janky, a little bit, you know, stuttery, and how they had all these internal projects to make it smoother. And they installed the Tumblr app on L, and it's smooth as butter, and they didn't change a thing. So there's clearly, like, speed improvements that you get, you know, kind of just for free. Like, it's very, very snappy. Even with all the transitions and sliding and effects, it looks really good.
Well, here's a page turn on a book. Is this Dieter doing that? It looks like Dieter.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Dieter Bohn of the Verge.
I mean, the keyboard looks nice. You got to – they're competing one-to-one with iOS now. I mean
– yeah.
Their design is so top-notch. And you got,
we had Nilay on TNT this morning, Nilay Patel from The Verge on TNT, and he said something I've been saying for a while, which is that iOS is out of date. And and they really haven't. Apple has not managed to keep up with Android. And just UI-wise, I really feel like Android has lapped iOS. So
material is really great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm excited about it.
All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, a tool, a tip, and a number. As we wrap this thing up, our show today brought to you by Shutterstock.com. We have a 25-image-a-day subscription to Shutterstock. A lot of publishing companies might do that. And it's a very affordable way to get royalty-free images. And you never run out because Shutterstock, they're kind of just a glutton. 43,632,261 royalty-free stock images on Shutterstock. 324,000 new images this week. What you might say, well, what the heck am I going to do with all those? Well, they have the best search engine that makes it so easy to find exactly what you want. And not just a thing. Like, I can search for, I don't know, a gorilla. And not just a thing like a gorilla. But then, and by the way, they have some of the best gorilla images ever. Then... Once you could say happy gorilla, you can narrow it down by emotion. Let me do a search for a gorilla, and then I'm going to press the refine your search button. I could choose gorilla vectors, photos, or illustrations, horizontal or vertical orientation. I could pick a category. I can exclude keywords. If there's an artist or a photographer I really like, I can choose their name. I love it. It's, you know what? Here's the problem. You're going to start playing with this, and you never stop. The good news is you can do this without paying a penny. Just sign up for an account. You don't even need to give them a credit card number. Now you can not only search images and play around with images, you can store them in a light box so you have access to the images. You can share that light box with colleagues and clients. Great resource for inspiration, for ideas. I love it. Shutterstock.com. Sign up for that free account right now. Play with the iPad or Android app. They're gorgeous. In fact, won a Webby Award for their design. And if you decide to purchase, we have an offer code for you, TWIG1014, and that's going to give you 20% off on a new account on any image package. The image subscription packages are really the best deal. And with 20% off, they're even better. Shutterstock.com, sign up for the Lightbox for the free account. When you decide to buy, just do me a favor, use TWIG1014. Oh, there's Gorilla Video. It's kind of... Shutterstock.com. Use the offer code TWIG1014. And now Gina Trapani has her tip of the week.
All right. This is one of those tips that is not news at all, but it's one of those things that isn't obvious and is super handy when you need it.
Okay.
So when you're in, you're using Google Maps navigation on your phone to get somewhere.
Yes.
If you tap the compass, you can toggle between first person view and the route view, which is really, really handy when you want to see, you know, what the entire route is. So, again, non-obvious.
I do that all the time because I always want to see, where the hell are you taking me?
Where are they taking me? Exactly.
I'm not doing it right now, Chad, so I can't. Exactly. What is this route?
When I read this, I was like, oh, right. Okay. Good to know. Because it's not, I mean, the compass doesn't exactly ask to be tapped.
Right.
So next time you're in navigation, tap on the compass. You can switch between those two views, both of which are very handy.
Nice. Jeff, your number of the week?
I'm going to cheat a little bit. I'm going to use the first, Mark Zuckerberg's first interview in Mandarin.
He answered in Mandarin?
He answered in Mandarin. I haven't watched the video yet, but there's a video there on the rundown.
What an overachiever.
Introduce the founder of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg.
Skip ahead to like... He's talking to students in China. They love it when you speak, even if you're terrible. He actually sounds pretty good. He's got to work on his tones, though. I studied Chinese in college for years, and I couldn't do this. That's pretty impressive.
I mean, as somebody said on Twitter where I found this, he did this while running the company. What did you do?
Yeah. And killing and dressing his own meat products.
Yes.
And tearing down his block.
Yeah.
I hate overachievers. Wow, that is very impressive. Chinese is an easy language.
That's great. Good for him. He actually seemed, the crowd loved it.
Oh, well, and I got to tell you that Chinese speakers love it when you, even if you are terrible, they go, oh, your accent's excellent.
My favorite moment when I visited China was I was walking through a public garden and happened upon who I assumed were locals, and my group raised our hands and said, ni hao, and they said, hello. And then we all just cracked
they
up.
Loved it.
Like everyone just started laughing. And it was fantastic. Yeah.
I like to go to the get the mani-pedis, and they're talking in Chinese the whole time. And at the end I go, "Oh, xie xie nin, zai jian." And they go, "Oh, yeah." You understood. I didn't, but I like to pretend.
You like to pretend.
Oh, no. That guy Jin knew what we were saying about him. So I did a full review of the Galaxy. Did you want to do another number, Jeff?
No, that's fine.
First is a number. It counts.
I cheated, but I could go into a whole bunch of numbers, but Andrew.
No, that was a good one. I liked seeing Mark Zuckerberg speak Chinese.
This is
good. So I did a full review of this on Before You Buy. This is the Galaxy Note 4. I got the unlocked edition. People are starting to get them now from the major carriers.
How much does that cost? $1,000?
No, not that bad. $850.
$850, okay.
You can get it for $300 Korea, subsidized.
In Korea, it was more than $1,000.
Wow. It's beautiful. I mean, this is a 5.7-inch Super AMOLED screen running at Quad HD. So it's, 2560 by 1440. And you can see it. It's really, really gorgeous. Here's the inbox app running on it. Text is crisp. You can't see any dots at all. I mean, it just really is a beautiful phone. Very fast. Quad-core processors, 2.7 gigahertz quad-core processors. I mean, that's desktop speeds now. And the main thing, you know, I'm not a fan of what Samsung does to Android, or haven't been. I am a fan of the Notes because I like the giant screens, and I've had every Note, 1, 2, 3, and 4, and
you
always loved it. Huh?
You use the pen?
Yeah, I mean, the pen works great.
I kind of like to have it once in a while.
Yeah, there's times when you want to take written notes, for instance, that this is very handy. They've got templates you can fill in. You can, if you work really hard at it, have the handwriting converted into text, but you have to write very nicely on a straight line, which I do not do. It also, as I pointed out, has a fingerprint reader that works and can be used for Google Wallet and other things. You could train up to 3 fingerprints. The only thing about the fingerprint reader, you see it's kind of wide. That's because you're scanning your fingerprints, so you have to cover it entirely. You learn how to do it pretty good, but it isn't as easy as Apple's where you just rest your finger on it. Apple seems to work every time, and this one takes a little practice. The main thing I want to say, and by the way, I'm running Nova Launcher here. I'm not running TouchWiz, as you probably could tell from the normal-looking dock, not the TouchWiz weird dock. And Samsung is king of just junking stuff up in the interface and so forth. But they have obviously listened to people, and they've junked it up so much less than, for instance, remember the camera used to have 800 different modes. They still have the same number of modes, but you can manage them and to hide the modes you don't want to use. Now, we were talking about how good the camera is going to be on the Nexus 6. I think there's no question. This is a 16-megapixel shooter that's spectacular. 3.7, I think, megapixel front camera with 120 degrees. So it's really a great selfie camera. It has some interesting, useful modes, but you don't have to see them all, which is nice. One of my biggest complaints about the Galaxy phones is the S voice, the Samsung voice. They replace Google search voice with. It's just, I want to use Google. You can. Okay, Google. I'm talking to you. Okay, Google. And it does the OK Google thing. And then every Google Android phone has done that since KitKat. You can also get Google Now by pressing and holding. So it's a much purer version of Android than Samsung has done, even on the Galaxy S5.
How's the battery?
Battery is massive. And I think the biggest argument for these phones is this is one of the few phones still remaining where you could take the cover off, put a new battery. So if you have two batteries, it is a 20 milliamp hour battery to begin with.
That thing is huge.
Yeah. And, you know, which means it's going to get you through the day. I don't have good battery numbers yet because I've only had it for a few days. I like to let the phone settle a little bit before I really get battery numbers. But I think it's going to be comparable to the OnePlus One. And, you know, for $20, you get a second battery and you never have to worry again. And SD card support. You know, the Nexus 6 isn't going to have either of these capabilities. So, I've always liked the Samsung phones for that reason alone. I can buy an extra battery and battery charger.
Is there a chance you'd like it more than the Nexus 6?
It's possible. We'll see. I'm going to buy a Nexus 6. Yeah. Nexus 6 doesn't have a removable back, doesn't have a stylus, but it has Lollipop. This is KitKat. And I don't expect Lollipop to show up for a Samsung phone right away by any means. But again, you put a launcher of your choice on there, and it's. I tell you that the screen is spectacular. We'll have to see what the Nexus 6 looks like. Nexus 6 has roughly the same battery, but it's not replaceable. It doesn't have SD cards. So, you know, you're going to have to get 64 gigs internal and hope that that's enough. Let's see. Nexus 6 has 3200. This has 3220. So they have 20 little milliamp hours better. I'm not saying rush out and get a Note 4, but if you did get a Note 4, I don't think you should feel left out. This is a pretty darn nice phone. It is a gorgeous phone. And, you know, if you show this, show my pocket, Chad. It's not that big. You know, it's so funny. When the Notes first came out, people said, oh, my God, that's huge. We're so used to big phones now. I can pocket it. It's not so different.
How big is that one?
It's a little smaller than the iPhone 6 Plus. I don't know the exact dimensions of it. But because, you know, it's almost edge to edge on the screen, the bezels aren't as big. Crappy back, single back speaker. That's one thing that Nexus 6 will do much better. So I don't know who's going to win on that one.
I said to my Korean hosts, I keep on saying, the world laughed at you for your big phones, but you got the last laugh.
I think so. Yeah. I love a big phone, and I don't use a tablet. I think you could use this on the train very happily. couple other quick notes. If you have a Samsung phone, you can go to the Samsung store and download Nokia's Here Maps and driving directions. Those are very good. Everybody loves those. And they have one advantage over Google Maps. You can use them offline. They will download maps before you head out the door by state, by city, by country. So you can just use them offline. Also, get the Fox app if you have FX or FXX on your TV, because the FX Now app now has every episode of The Simpsons ever. 25 seasons, 522 episodes on your phone. Now's a couple of little tips for you if you're getting on an airplane as I am. Thank you, Gina Trapani.
Thank you.
ThinkUp.com. Everybody should sign up today for that great Insights, Twitter Insights app.
Thank you. Yeah, a lot of fun today. Good show.
And she's
always
back to blogging on Scribbler.
Scribbling.net, yes.
Scribbling.net.
My writing muscles are pretty rusty, but I just decided that even if it's just a paragraph, I'm going to publish it.
Do. Keep doing it. Keep doing it. It'll be easier and easier and easier.
Yeah, it gets easier, right? It's a muscle for sure.
And I love your writing, so I'm just, as a reader, I want you to do it. Same with you, Jeff Jarvis. He blogs pretty regularly at Buzz Machine. He travels all around the world.
Twitter kind of ruined me.
Twitter ruined everything. Twitter is why we can't have nice things.
Yeah.
Twitter is the problem. Jeff is at the City University of New York, where a bunch of very lucky students get to study journalism with him. And both of them join us virtually every Wednesday at about 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, 2000 UTC. For This Week in Google. If you can't watch live, don't worry about it. On-demand audio and video always available after the fact. twit.tv/twig. That's our website. Or wherever podcasts are aggregated. iTunes. Stitcher's a good place. We have lovely third-party apps for almost every platform, including Roku. So you can download those and watch. So we have a lot of people watch on their big screen TVs in their living room on Roku. Thanks, Jeff. Thanks, Gina. Thanks, Chad Johnson, our producer. Thanks to you for watching. And we'll see you next week on Twig.